The stories of seeds evolve.
They evolve to explain something that ultimately can't be explained. But the relevance of those stories to our way of feeding ourselves, the agricultural cycle, the essence of the mystery of life, of birth and death and resurrection and returning to the earth and rising out of the earth, it's so extraordinary, it's so vast. I mean, it's a book in itself.
That's poet and farmer Scott Chasky talking about his new book, Seed Time. We spend the hour today talking with Chasky about the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. The first time I saw my guest, Scott Chasky, he was on top of a farm tractor, his sun reddened face tucked into a vast expanse of white beard that flowed down his chest. I had an impression of generous geniality, one that has subsequently been borne out over the years that I've come to know him. But that day, it made me feel welcome on my first time of harvesting my weekly share of vegetables, herbs, and flowers from Quail Hill Farm in Amagansett, New York. Chasky is the director of the farm, a CSA for Community Supported Agriculture. He's also a past president of the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York. And he's a poet. But his new book, Seed Time, while filled with his poetic sensibility for language, is an impassioned defense of humanity's age-old relationship with seeds. It's also a warning of the grave threats to our food supply posed by industrial agriculture and environmental degradation. The diversity of our seed supply is being lost just at a time when we need it more than ever. Scott Chasky is a revered figure on the East End of Long Island, a key player in shaping the region's awareness of sustainable food and farming. For a quarter century, as director of the Peconic Land Trust's farm at Quail Hill, he's promoted a whole systems approach to agriculture, an approach, he says, that practices cooperation with all living things, not exploitation of them. In Seed Time, he considers, quote, the web of biodiversity and resilience at the heart of our cultural inheritance. And he does this by weaving history, politics, botany, literature, mythology, and memoir into his profoundly moving book. Scott Chasky, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
So, Seed Time, on the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds. This is a wonderful book, a beautiful book, very much written in the sense of both your vocations, that is, as a farmer and a poet. You talk about how a seed is a book, but also how a seed is a poem.
What I wanted to get across in this book firstly has to do with the magic and the mystery of seeds, or the poetics of seeds. And this is such a crucial topic right now. I had to talk about the politics, and also I wanted to present the promise of it, but I really wanted it to start with the poetics of seeds. And to me, that really, simply stated, has to do with the mystery of the evolution of seeds and what seeds mean to us in the world. And there it is. That's what I began with.
You talk a bit about myth, the consciousness of myth, not in the sense of a myth being a lie or something that's mistaken, but as something that is connected to the mystery. Say more about what that kind of mythopoeic consciousness means as you think of yourself and as a farmer and as we can all think of ourselves as connected to a system of food and growth and seeds.
Well, you know, mythology at one time explained the world to those who live in the world. And I say at one time, I still think it does, which is why I felt there had to be a chapter, not so much about myths, but presenting mythologies of seeds, because those mythologies in themselves are wonderful stories. And I'm telling stories throughout the book. And in fact, I end with a chapter where I discuss the need for a new story. So much of the book is about that. And ultimately, mythologies are that. They are the stories of the earth and of ourselves. And in that chapter, which for me was sort of the most surprising and sort of revelatory of the writing experience, because I didn't really plan on it so much, but it evolved. And that's how I think the stories about seeds happen. They evolve to explain something that ultimately can't be explained. But the relevance of those stories to our way of feeding ourselves, the agricultural cycle, the essence of the mystery of life, of birth and death and resurrection and returning to the earth and rising out of the earth. It's so extraordinary. It's so vast. I mean, it's a book in itself, and maybe I'll get a chance to write that one too.
What is that new story of seeds that you want to tell?
Well, the new story really has to do with the promise that I do speak about in the book of the, it mostly has to do with the young people who I've witnessed getting involved in sustainable agriculture and community agriculture, because that's where I've been. That's how I've, you know, what the practice I've been doing for, you know, the last 25 years or so. And there is such an intense interest in reviving not the old ways, but in finding a new way to make use of something that sustained us for 10,000 years. And I see that in young people and in a few extraordinary people in this country who are teaching young people, you know, the art of saving seeds, because it's an art that has somewhat been lost, quite a bit been lost. But there's some great people teaching about it and some young people getting into it and learning on their own. And then, you know, it's basically a revival. And it's not only in this country, it's really all over the world. And so that's the promise that the book finally comes to.
You mentioned the evolution of seeds. You say that our entire food supply is the gift of the angiosperms. Tell us a little bit about that evolution. What is an angiosperm? How did they come about?
Well, so, you know, the first seeded plants were the gymnosperms. And I have to go back because I forget the exact years, but say it's 260 million years ago. It wasn't until 140 million years that the angiosperms arrived. The story that I love about that is Darwin's expression that he called it abominable, that because he couldn't explain where they came from. Where did these seeded plants come from? Because a gymnosperm does not flower. So the angiosperm is an encased seed, and it can travel further, and, you know, and it's not only reproducing by, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of pollen grains wafted on the wind. So it's a more exact process. And, you know, if Darwin couldn't guess where that came from, you know, we can't either. But it happened. And so when the flowering plants arrived on the world, it would be, I mean, obviously this happened over many, many, many years, but it was really a tremendous transformation of what was possible on the earth.
And why is that? I mean, the gymnosperms are like the ferns.
The ferns are spore plants, so they came before, and the gymnosperms are the evergreens, basically, and the conifers. Just think of a cone. So when, you know, if you want to think of a gymnosperm, and although they've had tremendous success on the earth, because there are, you know, forests everywhere, you know, of gymnosperm plants, the evolution of the seeded plants brought a whole explosion of insects and animals and ultimately us. So until that happened, until there was food being produced,
food
being produced by plants, you know, it was a slower process that was happening on the earth. So
you mentioned also the politics, which is an important part of your book, maybe not the one that you went into the original idea when you were first thinking about this book. It probably wasn't as important, but it has become more important over time. And it has very much to do with the struggle over diversity, I think, of seeds and the need to preserve the diversity of seeds. What's happening to seed diversity and why is that so important to maintain?
Well, it's really, you know, biodiversity is sort of the key word, biodiversity, and that's used over and over again in the book. And I do draw on some really great books in writing Seed Time. There's one I want to mention that's sort of the key book to read about the importance of diversity, and that's a book called Shattering by Cary Fowler. It's an amazing book, and written in 1989, maybe something like that, and where he says that we're in the midst of a mass extinction event in agriculture, and that was, of course, written, you know, 20-some years ago. And increasingly, we're still in that. And it really has to do with at a time where we need to increase diversity so that there's more of a chance to for us and plants to adapt to climate change, we're going in the other direction. And so, of course, if you're talking about the lack of diversity in agriculture, in large-scale industrial agriculture, you're talking about monocropping, and there have been disasters having to do with an insect or a disease problem affecting one type of plant. It turns out if you followed this back into, say, that there was a corn blight in the 70s, and it turns out there were six different parents, you know, of all the corn plants being planted on a large scale in this country, and it was an incredible disaster. If you go back further, the Irish potato famine was caught because the potatoes being brought from South America, all the potatoes planted in Europe came from two parents. And then it took many, after the blight hit, which was devastating, not only just in Ireland over that, you know, everyone knows about that, but in fact, it was the blight spread all throughout Europe and went on for, 40 years or more. And then it took breeders a lot of time to breed resistant varieties, etc. So the thing is, if you take away diversity, you're narrowing your chances, our own chances as humans and the chances of all other life of being able to adapt and to change as we need to as part of living, basically.
That's a very telling example, the potato famine. Talk a little bit about the birth of the potato and the conditions under which it evolved into an incredible variety of potatoes in its native land. It's a kind of an object lesson to us.
So, you know, the birthplace is in the Andes, and there's still 3,000 or more varieties that are grown there, perhaps more than that. I don't know. This is a figure that I read. And the diversity arises from a grower, you know, an indigenous farmer wanting a certain trait or a certain taste or, you know, and then making adjustments in plants, and one village making, you know, the farmers in one village learning about a particular variety and wanting to produce a variety of their own. And then, you know, over a great period of time, you know, there's a diversity of plants that are bred by humans and that also come from an interaction with wild plants, you know, et cetera. And so, you know, carefully, potatoes, I don't know how many thousands of years it took to evolve, you know, that many varieties. But when the potato was discovered, it's probably very telling about the kind of process because, you know, it was discovered in a process of conquering, right? And so the conquerors took the potato to Europe. It wasn't accepted right away. It took quite a long time. There's some really great stories about how potatoes spread. But once they did, the fact is that humans could actually, it's a very complete food. And so with the addition of a little bit of calcium from milk, people could survive and be fairly healthy on potatoes and dairy, basically. And so that's basically what happened in Ireland. And then what does that lead to? That leads to, this is the problem. We're talking about diversity or biodiversity in plant life or in the environment. In fact, the lack of diversity as humans encounter it leads to one man dominating another, basically. It leads to the conqueror. You know, I mean, that's the problem. When we're talking about it, you can't really isolate just how we're growing plants, you know, in relation to trying to come up with new varieties and everything. It's
from our social and political relations.
Yes, right.
Yes, and so I was thinking about that example. There were plants that had resistance built into them. I'm not sure in the case of the potato if it was stored in a wild variety, although you point out in your book, Scott Chasky, in Seed Time, that the wild species of domesticated plants are often the store of diversity and resistance. And I was thinking, what if that had happened today? We would be in a much worse position today. Now we have these huge corporations that are buying up the genes, the very book of life, and trying to control the access of the rest of us to it.
Well, I suppose ultimately that really has to do with a profit mentality, right? I mean, ultimately that's what it has to do with. And it's obviously such a narrow way of viewing reality in my mind. I mean, if you're, you know, working within what I've been involved with, the kind of agriculture I've been involved with is called a whole systems approach, you know, and so you're looking at how to work with your environment and to learn to cooperate with all living things that are involved in the environment where you are. And in your question, we're talking about something very different, really.
Right. I just was wondering, if we faced the same thing today, which in some ways we do, because I know there's a wheat rust that's affecting crops, would we even have the flexibility to develop?
Well, we don't. I mean, we don't have that flexibility. There's less and less. And that's why, you know, Carrie Fowler made the statement about the mass extinction event, because if you're extinguishing your ability to create new varieties, then you're narrowing your chances, basically. And that's where we are. So we have to go in the other direction.
And your book does go into that. But before we get into that, I'd like to explore a little bit more of some of the how we got to where we were and to where we are right now. For most of human history, seeds were open pollinated. Mm-hmm. Now we have hybrids. I've been a gardener for many years, and, you know, I'd buy hybrids because they were, you know, I kind of knew what I was getting, and it looked like they had all kinds of disease-resistant traits. And talk about the difference between hybrid seeds and open-pollinated seeds, and what are the pros and cons of them?
So open-pollinated plants are plants that reproduce freely on their own. Hybrid plants are plants that are where we have intervened. And ultimately, although hybridization takes place in nature as well, there's natural hybrid process. The hybrids that have created somewhat of a problem in the kind of industrial agriculture that is most common today have to do with breeders inbreeding, so taking two inbred lines and coming up with a plant that produces something called hybrid vigor and therefore is more reliable, and at least for 1 year the gardener knows what to expect, etc. But the gardener or farmer then has to go back to the breeder or the seed company to purchase that same seed. There's nothing particularly wrong with that that process. And as I say, somewhere in the book, I say hybrids are not inherently evil, and we use many hybrids. The thing is, open pollinated plants lead to more diversity, right? So, and there are many different ways that breeders use open pollinated plants, and breeders can come up with new varieties that is a different process than the hybrid process, etc. But it's the fact that we're eliminating, you know, the diversity by producing more and more hybrids and by specializing in creating seeds that then farmers and gardeners have to return again and again to the source instead of creating more diversity by planting open pollinated plants. That's really the problem.
So this is kind of one stage on the way to where we were, and then a huge corner was, or maybe another, a whole other stage developed from that with the development of genetically engineered crops, genetically modified organisms, GMO. How did the development of genetically modified crops or seeds, how did this break seed time?
Well, because up until the genetic engineering process came into existence, we, even through hybridization or different other breeding techniques, we weren't crossing species lines. So it was no one, you know, until the genetic engineering broke in the 20th century, no one had thought of, you know, breeding a fish gene into a tomato, which is what happened with the, you know, the first genetic engineered vegetable crop to come onto the market, or breeding a pig with a potato. This sounds absurd, but in fact, this is what happens in genetic engineering. It's actually genes from different species are inserted into the genetic makeup of one to the other. That's just an entirely different process. And oddly, the proponents of genetic engineering have said, well, you know, we've been breeding this and that for forever, and you know, we've been altering plants. And yes, we have, but we have not altered plants by inserting genes of another species into it. So that's just a whole new universe, basically.
What is the problem with that? And is the problem in that in itself? I mean, I can hear the other side saying, just because we haven't done it, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with it. Or is it because the way that's being done is being done to foster, for example, the use of more pesticides because they're breeding, they're genetically developing genetically engineered corn that is Roundup ready. In other words, it won't die when you apply huge amounts of pesticides to the soil. So is the problem more that the reason they're using it is in a way that is contaminating the earth or making things worse environmentally and socially, or is the problem in the process itself?
Personally, I would say it's in the process itself.
Why?
Because we simply don't know enough about it. So, you know, for me, that's about as far as you go. We're releasing something where we don't know what the results are going to be. I would rather have the proof the other way around. We would rather have the proof that we know how this is going to react in our environment. The thing is, some people have said it's like, you know, throwing a firecracker or a bomb, I suppose you could say, into an ecology, because it's released, it's there, and now there's natural crossbreeding going on with wild plants. We have no idea. There's not enough testing to know what happens. There has been enough testing done more recently. There have been some, you know, 2-year studies to show that laboratory animals fed on GMO products are having all sorts of bodily functions, you know, not working, etc. So that's something new. So to me, that is a faulty process, and that's it has taken a few years to produce the scientific results that, of course, are always demanded by the proponents of a new technology, who say, well, there's nothing wrong with this technology. We've been doing this over and over again. But in fact, that's a myth. So that's sort of your first question. The second one is maybe a bigger problem, but it's secondary, you know what I mean? Which is that, yes, the myth now is that by using genetically engineered crops, we will lessen the amount of pesticides and herbicides that are being used. But in fact, that's totally false. In fact, it's gone the other way. It's actually increased. So it's another big problem. That's enough of a problem in itself, but I would, you know, go back to the first one, that I think inherently it's problematic because we just don't know enough about it. I don't know, just take one random example. Not long ago, within a year, some GMO wheat, genetically engineered wheat, was found in a field in Oregon, not planted by the farmer. And there is no GMO wheat planted in this country, supposedly. It was tried some years ago, but it apparently, you know, wheat is an interesting and very complicated plant and doesn't lend itself to genetic engineering, which I'm happy for. But what's this, if none exists, and, you know, so what that comes down to is that there were some trials of GMO wheat done years ago, never received the okay to be produced, and nor is it supposedly being grown on any acreage in this country, and yet there it is. It's in a field in Oregon. So obviously, you know, once genetic material, foreign genetic material, is released into an environment, it's going to combine with other plants, and we don't know where that leads.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet and farmer Scott Chasky about his new book, Seed Time. This has been a huge issue for organic farmers that you talk about, because organic farmers, in order to have a crop be certified organic, it cannot have any genetically engineered seeds in it or engineered qualities to the crop, to the food. And you've had genetic drift of GMO corn pollen carried on the wind that has contaminated fields nearby that were owned by organic farmers. And they brought suit against Monsanto, which has developed this corn, the organic seed, I don't remember the exact name, but the organic seed organization. Yeah. And they lost in court. The judge said that they didn't have standing mm-hmm. to sue Monsanto. Explain this judgment, and why do you think it came about?
Well, I think it came about because, and this, by the way, this was, I've been part of NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York, specifically for many years, and we were a co-signer onto this as well. I believe there were 280 organizations or individuals involved with this lawsuit, and ultimately, as explained by C.R. Lawn, who I quote a number of times in the book, who's one of the founders of Fedco Seeds, and has some great writings that explain this sort of terminology and everything, because it does get very complicated. His explanation was the judge simply did not understand the issue. So that's, you know, why? Because there are some complications to it. But what this was, this suit was an attempt to forestall Monsanto from being able to sue farmers, which they've been doing for quite a long time. And this judge, not understanding the true issues, ruled that there was no standing, that in fact, that there was no, in a way to sort of simplify it, that this was arguing that an event had not occurred. So this wasn't about a specific event. This was about a sort of philosophical difference.
So what's happened, I mean, ironically, Monsanto has been suing farmers who did not buy Monsanto seeds, but yes. have found that their fields have been contaminated yes. by Monsanto seed that other farmers have planted. Yes. So they've sued Monsanto, the company has sued them for violation of intellectual property rights. And these farmers were then trying to say, no, we are suing Monsanto because we want to forestall its ability to sue us.
Yes, basically.
I see. So then what about the case of farmers who are organic farmers like yourself, whose food may be contaminated by these seeds and can no longer then claim that their crops are organic because it's been contaminated? Has that happened as well?
Yes, that has happened. And that's why the instance I'm thinking about right now was a farmer from Kansas, I believe, who was suing because Japan would not import his product anymore because Japan had heard that there was, you know, GMO contamination in various places in this country. So then he was suing, saying, well, this is my livelihood and I can't sell my product. And yet I had nothing to do with, you know, I mean, the contamination had nothing to do with me. There are other suits that are kind of that point out the problem, I think, more specifically, like Percy Schmeiser's, this Canadian farmer, right, with canola, where he had bred his own variety for 50 years, and some GMO canola, you know, literally blew into his field from a neighbor, and Monsanto sued. He had never bought the seed. He had never signed an agreement with Monsanto, nothing. And yet they were allowed to come into his field and then do tests and sue him But meanwhile, he lost the crop that he had bred for 50 years. So it's an extraordinary, when you hear a story like you say, how is this even possible? And in fact, Monsanto won in court, you know, on technicalities. In the end, it was eventually overturned, but it's only because Percy Smyser kept fighting and was the kind of, he was actually a local politician and he wasn't going to give up. And he kept at it. But it's an example of reverse logic. How do you make any sense of that at all? And so ultimately, I just want to mention that the problem actually comes down to a 1992 ruling during the first Bush administration that ruled that genetically engineered crops were substantially equivalent, that's the terminology, were substantially equivalent to traditional crops. And that ruling and all other cases of law following on from that are determined by that ruling. It's never been changed. In fact, that it's totally false. They are not substantially equivalent, and that's fairly easy to prove. But our U.S. law is based upon that ruling.
And so why is that important, that they're ruled that they're substantially equivalent?
Well, because because legally it's impossible to basically argue against the release of genetically engineered into the atmosphere because the law reads that they're substantially equivalent.
Scott Chasky, organic farmer and poet, and author of Seed Time. We'll talk more after the break. Stay tuned.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, God bless these seeds I sow, and warm them from below till the rain comes tumbling down. Pulling weeds, picking stones, man is made of dreams and bones. Feel the need to grow my own, 'cause the time is close at hand. Rain for grain, sun and rain, find my way in nature's chain. Tune my body.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking this hour about the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds. That's the subtitle of my guest Scott Chasky's latest book, Seed Time. Just before the break, we were talking about genetically engineered seeds, organisms often designed to tolerate large amounts of pesticides. Chasky has deep reservations about GMOs. He thinks they're a huge, uncontrolled experiment that's being carried out with adverse impacts on human health, the environment, and on seed diversity. Impacts that are just being discovered. Now, a lot of people who are in favor of GMO food say we are heading towards a planet with 9 billion people and there's going to be no way to feed all those people unless we genetically engineer crops, for example, and they usually trot out the idea of this rice that is very high in vitamin A content. And they say, you know, with this, we can deal with the nutritional deficiencies that are coming down the pike. What's your answer to them? Do we need to do a deal with the devil just to feed the 9 billion? Or is there an alternative model?
Well, I think it's a smokescreen, to be quite honest. I mean, it's the newest tech. We're always searching for the newest technology. Boy, it was difficult to write the chapter about all of this because it's, again, you know, it could be 10 books, you know, just to discuss how this has been laid out, you know, over the decades, because if you have to really go back to the 20s, you know, to the 1920s to sort of lay this whole thing out. But the smokescreen is that, you know, this happened with the Green Revolution, as it was called, which was called, you know, that was the technological fix at the time. And this was what it would take to feed the world. And in fact, that isn't what happened at all. I mean, almost as soon as it was rolled out, it turned out that what was really happening is that U.S. corporations were, you know, profiting from something that wasn't producing the wasn't feeding the masses as was the case, and exactly what's happening with GMOs. But in fact, there have been trials done over a long enough period of time now, because Rodale Research Farm has been doing trials side by side of conventional crops and organic crops for quite a long time now, and has shown that although oftentimes the organic crops don't show the same kind of yield, because it often comes down to yield, don't show the same kind of yield, that eventually over a period of years they do, and in fact often show greater yields. So it's interesting that, you know, we have to come up with the scientific knowledge to prove something to slow down the next quick fix. And yet the other factor to mention is that 70% of the agriculture that feeds the world is small-scale agriculture throughout the world. And so we're dealing with 30% that we're saying this is what's going to feed the world, but that isn't the case. It isn't even happening now.
And hasn't the introduction of the GMO seeds also, I mean, it hasn't exactly solved the problem of poverty among, say, India's farmers?
Well, no, it's led in the other direction. No, that's very true. And I just want to mention Vandana Shiva's name, because she's the great spokesperson for the Indian farmers and really for the non-GMO movement throughout the world, basically. So.
And she has a seed bank that she is developing with women farmers in India.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a nice segue into a conversation about seed saving, which is such an important part of what you write about in this book, Scott Chaskey, and In Seed Time. The practice, I believe, if I've pronounced it correctly, is Bharanaja.
Yeah, right.
Tell us what Bharanaja is and why Vandana Shiva says this is so connected to food democracy.
It's a way of actually broadcasting different varieties of plants that can enhance one another. It's the opposite of monocrop farming. So, and it's obviously builds on the concept of creating more diversity. And perhaps this can't be done on a huge scale in the breadbasket of the United States, but it can be done and feed a lot of people on smaller scales. And that is what's happening in places like India and in other places. But she's also re-educating. Well, just have the see the you know just understand the concept of industrial agriculture coming in with new seeds that have to be purchased by indigenous farmers every year, so therefore it's more costly. And then to make the seeds work, they have to buy the pesticides or herbicides that go with it, and the companies are profiting from that, etc. And the opposite is what Vandana Shiva is doing, which is keeping alive the traditions that have existed in the country of dealing with diversity and of saving seeds and passing on that knowledge. That's really what she's doing, yeah.
So I think maybe some of our listeners have heard of the Doomsday Seed Bank up in the Arctic Circle in Norway. Tell us about this. It's called Svalbard.
Svalbard is the name of the islands north of Norway. And the Norwegian government apparently has long been fostering seed saving. And it's a very long process that led to the location of the seed bank there. And Carrie Fowler, who has worked on this for about 20 years, and who knows how many meetings, it took to create the seed bank. But the point is, it's above the Arctic Circle and it's in a permafrost mountain. So the temperature is controlled naturally. And I can't remember how many degrees below zero, but it's cold enough so that the seeds are kept there. you know, they have to be brought out every now and then, and you can't just put seeds away forever. So it's not really a doomsday vault. And he doesn't like that. He doesn't like it sounding like that, obviously, because hopefully storing seeds that will allow us to use some varieties that are continually lost year by year, so that they can be released to breeders to use this and breeding new varieties, etc. And without those seeds, every year we're losing more and more varieties. So the whole point is to keep them in one place, in one seed bank, rather than to have seeds scattered around the globe in oftentimes problematic regions, or, you know, just think of the seed storage in Iraq or in Syria. Both of those were actually, the seeds were taken from those seed banks and stored, you know, luckily. Usually there's a steward of each seed bank, but I think it's been said that, you know, of the more than 1,000 seed banks scattered around the globe, most of them are in areas where we don't know how long they're going to last, or, you know, for the various problems. So the idea was to have this seed bank up in a safe spot on Svalbard in a permafrost mountain, where seeds that are found in each one of these different seed banks are, there's a copy of that seed being stored in Svalbard. It's an extraordinary idea. I haven't visited, but it just amazes me that the process of coordinating, you know, shipping seeds there and storing and carrying, etc. It's an enormous undertaking.
And are people getting access to those seeds now so that they can use them for further? I mean, is it just the idea that they're going to stay there until someone makes a decision that they have to use them, or how does that work?
No, the access supposedly is in place. I mean, that the access is controlled by whatever country or seed bank passes seeds on. It has free access to them at any time. That's how it's been set up.
And can countries share in that? Is it like the world's seed bank?
Well, I think it's been called that. When things are working well in this kind of commerce, just like any scientist, you know, sharing knowledge with another scientist in another country, it's sort of, you know, the borders are eliminated, hopefully. And so that's, that kind of free exchange has occurred for most of man's existence. The problem that we've gotten into, you know, since the early 20th century is the patenting of seeds, which has eliminated the free exchange. And so that's why Vandana Shiva goes back to, you know, creating a democracy of seeds, a freedom of seeds. And Svalbard, at least ideally, is participating in that kind of free exchange.
And it's not the only one. As you point out, there are 1,000 seed banks, that there's a whole revival in seed saving. Let's say if somebody listening to this program might want to participate in seed saving, where would they go? What would they do?
Well, I would look locally, and, you know, I first talk to a local farmer, or, you know, you could probably find something out from your local extension. You know, if you're in touch with one of the land grant universities, you go to a national source, which is the Seed Savers Exchange, and be linked through their catalog to over 13,000 varieties in this yearly catalog, and be linked to seed savers all over the country. And you'd find out pretty quickly that who was saving seeds locally, because they're listed in the Seed Savers Exchange catalog. I think that's probably a great source. But, you know, say you live in Arizona, and you know, now you can Google seed saving, and you'll come up with, you know, the people who are involved with the Seed Savers Native Seed Search, it's called, started by Gary Paul Nabhan, whose books are beautiful and had tremendous influence on me writing this. So they now have seed schools, which were originally held at Native Seed Search, but which now they're actually taking and going on the road and teaching these seed schools all around the country. And it's really just to disseminate the knowledge, you know, re-educate people. And that's the promise, is that's happening over and over again. And I keep meeting, you know, I met a wonderful couple at the NOFA New York Winter Conference who have newly started something called Fruition Seeds. And their whole impetus is to save is to create a seed source, a local seed source for the New York area. They're upstate New York and perhaps New England if you wanted to extend it into a region, but you're going to have the best luck with plants that are, you know, have been bred in your local environment. And so, I mean, I think there's enough information out there that anybody can find out about it if they do a little searching.
We're talking with Scott Chasky. His new book is Seed Time, On the History, Husbandry, Politics, and Promise of Seeds. So you mentioned local, and you are the director of a local farm, a community-supported agriculture farm, Quail Hill, in the east end of Long Island. You have been involved in developing some local varieties or using varieties that are adapted locally, I would say, more. What is a land race, and why is it important, and how have you used land races at your farm?
You know, we probably haven't used many seeds which could be termed land race, but it's an important point that land races are... let's just think of it this way, going back as far as you can on the chain to the original plant that was indigenous to a particular area. So those are the land race varieties. So if you go back to what originally grew in a particular area, I mean, there are wheat varieties, for instance, that were in existence 10,000 years ago that are still in existence. And there's actually a kind of comeback now of heritage wheat breeding.
Like Emmer,
yeah,
and Faro.
Einkorn, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, say a little bit about them. But you also, you've been growing wheat that's adapted for this area as well.
Yeah, we're just getting into that because we, you know, are as being a community supported agriculture farm, we have 500 different varieties. That's what we've experimented with the most is that, you know, in that may be 60 different crops or something, but we have 500 different varieties, but we sort of get them from wherever and we do a little bit of seed saving, but we're only just beginning to learn that. And of course, I learn a lot more by doing the research and writing the book. But we're just trying to connect with everybody in our area who is doing that. And we love, you know, trying to get back. And we've used some, you know, land race varieties natural to New England, etc. And lots of open pollinated and tried saving, you know, seeds from many different types of crops as well. Largely because we find, and I've heard this from other farmers, that plants that become adapted to your own soil can perform better and have more inbred resistance, you know, to disease problems and all that sort of thing. So we're doing what we can with that, yeah.
So you've been growing wheat. I actually, this is so funny because I was a recipient of a whole bunch of wheat berries. Mm. From the farm. I still have a lot of them in my refrigerator where I've kept them. I never even thought of grinding them into flour. Uh-huh. I had so lost the connection that I thought wheat berry cereal.
Something different, yeah.
But not wheat berry flour, but that is what makes bread.
That's it. That's the seed is the grain, is the flour, basically. And we actually recently purchased this beautiful little mill, a little portable mill, beautifully made in Germany, and pour in the wheat berries and flick the switch. And, you know, just the way, you know, great mills, if you picture, you know, almost everybody's seen like the stone that is used to for the grinding stone, right? That's used to actually, you know, produce flour from wheat berries. That's what they are. They're the seed. And we've got this little portable mill and you pour in the wheat berries and out comes flour. And it's extraordinary. When we show people this, they're always kind of looking sideways like, how did that happen? Which is interesting because we've all, it's certainly the last couple generations in this country have gone to buy their flour, King Arthur or whatever, in the supermarket or in the local store or something. But in fact, in India, at least in traditional societies there, they wouldn't think of buying bags of flour. They would go to whoever the miller was in the village. I'm talking about now. I'm not talking about, you know, long ago, and get fresh flour ground to use for that evening's chapatis or whatever, because...
Because it's better.
Because it's better, because it has to be fresh, basically, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I grind coffee beans to make my coffee.
Yes, right.
So, another crop that you've experimented with on the farm on Quail Hill is garlic, and I can attest to the marvelous flavor of the garlic that you grow there, the Amagansett peach.
Right. Well, that's a good example of, we've brought in different varieties of garlic over the years, and then we've found that if we grow it, because we save our own seed, we'll call it. It's not traditional seed. It's because it reproduces by a clove, by a vegetative process, just the way a daffodil, when you plant, you know, a bulb for a daffodil or a narcissa flower. So when we save our own seed and replant the cloves, it naturalizes, eventually it changes color. So we may bring in a garlic that many garlics have a reddish tint to them, sort of a red stripey, and they're, you know, different, you know, red German or Rioja or Spanish red or whatever it is. And in a couple of years, it takes on a peachy color in our soil. I have no idea why. I'm sure that someone could explain it to me, but I'm not sure I need to know. It tastes delicious, and so we rename it Amagansett peach if we figure we've been growing it long enough in our soil. My favorite crop.
Why is that?
First, because I love the flavor, and I mean, I use it in cooking every day. I love the flavor and what it gives to any assortment of foods. But the other part is that it's actually in the ground for 8 to 9 months. It's planted in the autumn. And for someone who is more used to growing annual crops, it's sort of a quick process. So you get to know the garlic more. You get to know it as a plant. And as you're caring for it, you get a little closer to it. That's how I feel about it, basically. Mm-hmm.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Scott Chasky, poet and farmer, about his book, Seed Time. The soil, which receives the seed, you have a very beautiful passage in the book about soil and turning it over. I'd like to ask you to read it, if you'd like. So maybe just set us up a little bit with this, and then read from that.
I begin with this passage. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read from the chapter, which is called Seed Freedom. And I think until this point in the book, I have not discussed soil so much, which I did in another book. And of course, what could be more important when you're talking about the seed? And so in this passage, I go back and talk about the soils that I've known, where I've lived. And the passage that I'm referring to is, to begin the chapter, comes from one of my favorite books, which is called Joy of Man's Desiring by Jean Giono.
And our many listeners would know him because he wrote the book The Man Who Planted Trees.
Right. I begin with this passage because, more than any other, it evokes the very bodily joy of turning the earth, and of the calling, from the air, the stars, the soil, to do so. I am reminded of a familiar feeling of resting on the handle of a spade and looking back on the deep brown earth, newly spaded over in a garden on Boar's Hill, Oxford, and of lifting the rich soil of Penwith, Cornwall, with each dip of the long-handled shovel, dropping the handle onto my thigh, just above the knee, to throw the soil up the steep incline, working as a plow across and back the contour of the compact cliff meadow, and of bending down to lift a palmful of Amagansett silt loam from the furrow after the chisel plow has first opened the soil in April, noting the shine on the steel shanks. To raise a crop with some success and to husband a plant to produce ripe fruit, a gardener or farmer needs to know the soil in changing weather, the character and adaptability of the seed, and how to prepare a seed bed. The soil is mineral matter, and when nourished, it is alive with micro and macro fauna and seeds native to the place, deposited by previous plant species, by wind, by passing birds. A farmer comes to sense the pulse of life within the soil, and in spring, the song rises up, calling for seeds. It is time to invest in the earth, to lower the plow, to introduce the soil again to the air, to loosen and ply apart the contraction of winter. The seed bed should be clean and fine to ensure germination, organic matter given over, folded in from the previous season to enrich the soil that receives the seed.
That's so beautiful. And you are a poet, as we mentioned before. Is there a poem, either from the book or that you have inside your prodigious memory banks that you would like to read to us?
Well, I'll read this little passage right here, because this comes from the afterword. And this is something that I wrote while living in Cornwall. And this is simply called Envoy, and it was it introduced a book of poetry and described the landscape, or better yet, the seascape of that place, the southwest tip of England. First light rides rocking water, stone blooms brush by windrush on sky and the crackers, herbs and bone illumine dark earth where blue stars sleep under the candles of Alcamilla. What I hope is that there's poetry throughout the book. There are some lines here and there, but to me the music of language is ever present wherever words are spoken or written, and so that's the only way I can write.
And one hears that when you read. Well, it is a beautiful book and an important book on many levels. Seed Time, and Scott Chaskey, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you.
Scott Chaskey practices poetry and farming on the east end of Long Island. In addition to Seed Time, he's the author of the memoir This Common Ground, Seasons on an Organic Farm. Find links about seed saving at writersvoice.net. Scott Chaskey practices poetry and farming on the east end of Long Island. In addition to Seed Time, he's the author of the memoir This Common Ground, Seasons on an Organic Farm. Find links about seed saving at writersvoice.net. We've just enough time for a poem. Here's Amy Dryansky reading the title poem from her recently published collection, Grass Whistle.
Grass Whistle. What I wanted was a rose, an open mouth. What I got was this slender blade of grass. It can sing or cut. Stretch it taut between your thumbs and send your breath there. A little breath and a little time. What comes out the other side? Who slips out the back door? What did you hide beneath your mattress you wanted nobody to see? Hold it to the light. Is it smaller than you remember? Does it still sting? Climb down from your treehouse and feel how the cool earth yields to your bare feet. That's a kind of welcome. Remember this when you're falling, or falling asleep, take the dream you're given, pull the covers up tight. Who are you tonight? This morning I'm the one who got away. Last night, the one who couldn't run fast enough. Most of the time, I'm the one who has to choose. I can't. My closets are bursting, the attics full of what I love, broken or breaking. Tonight, I'll dream of what to let go. To get ready, I'll unpack, put the books back on their shelves, comb dead leaves from my hair, memorize some commandments. I can't lay down my sword and shield, but if I stand very still, I might hear the wind move around me.
Amy Dryansky reading her poem, Grass Whistle. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our interview with Amy Dryansky. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.